Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. We are here at CSA Gym in Dublin, California. I'm joined, as always, by Meticulous Max Montana.
Ooh, that's a good
Meticulous
one.
Except, you know, about his appearance or really anything else. And our guest today, Mr. Jesse Burdick. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for coming along, man. Glad to be here.
Our episode today is brought to you by Big Heads and Banded Deads. It's a lifestyle. I'm really enjoying making them themed to the guests.
That's a good one.
It's good. Thank you very much.
It was one thing to just make up random lifestyle. To found actual lifestyle companies or the real companies who are sponsoring us. But now making them themed to the guest is
I appreciate it. Very, very much.
Fun
very
extra
that works. And I mean, you have the alliteration going too. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff there. That'll sell hundreds of possible t-shirts.
Yeah. It can't really be a lifestyle unless it's an alliteration.
I believe
that's the way it goes.
I think that is a rule.
Close.
Yeah, the sound.
Or it's got to have some sort of a rhyme, a rhythm to it for sure.
Yeah, a rhythm. A lot of our, no offense to our viewers and listeners, they're always commenting lifestyle brands, ideas of their own on the YouTube comments and stuff. And a lot of them fail to understand this rhythm.
Right. You
know. There's a lot of nuance to it.
People will just put in two different things, just completely different objects or two different nouns, and that's a lifestyle.
That's true.
There's got to roll off the tongue.
Someone following us on Instagram, and theirs was CrossFit and macros was like their...
It's not really.
Exercise and food.
Yeah, exercise. Yeah. Well, yeah. I think exercise and food would go better than CrossFit and macros. Yeah.
Exercise
and food.
But at least have some kind of...
See, that should be your neck. That
irony.
Would be a great t-shirt. Yeah. Just exercise and food.
Yeah. And it would be brilliant in its simplicity.
I agree. I think that would be awesome. I'll wear that t-shirt.
Yeah. Especially if you put it in parentheses, exercise and food... Because then it's like an insert whatever ones
exactly.
you want.
Oh, right.
Which
exactly.
is all lifestyle
you just interpret, exactly. You interpret it for everything and anything. That's
whichever are the ones that you like.
There's a guy watching this that's already printed that shirt now.
It's true.
It's already coming out.
Send me one, 2X, please.
TM. TM.
2X.
Yeah, TMCWS.
If you just say it, it counts. Right? You just declare TM and it's good. You're
just
solid.
Threw out five fucking letters there. That doesn't really mean, that doesn't hold up anywhere. Well, I appreciate the,
When they hear from my lawyer, we'll see how that holds up.
Don't you have to mail it to yourself and not open the mail? But then one day you can go to court and it's postmarked. You can tear it open and be like, see? I discovered this a week before it came out as a shirt.
People have tried to do that, but they've gone to court and it's never really held up.
I feel like that's a thing.
It is a thing. People do it, but I don't think it really holds up very much. But good luck.
We'll see. We'll see. All right. So we're here in the power room at CSA, your home base. Tell us a little bit about what you do here with the gym, with PowerWad, and sort of how you got into powerlifting.
Okay, a lot of different stories there. But what I do here is, so I have basically the strength and conditioning side of the gym. We have the MMA side up front, the CrossFit side in the middle, and then I have my stuff back here where I train the athletes, powerlifters, anyone who just kind of wants to get strong.
Notice the distinction between athlete and powerlifter. Two separate things.
You know, I think, I don't know, were you like this early on? You tried to call yourself a strength athlete? I did.
Yeah, especially having actually been
a prior athlete.
Yeah, an athlete before. Yeah, I make the same distinction of powerlifting and athletes.
Yeah. So, I tried to be strength athlete or power athlete, and then after a while, I was like, I'm just a powerlifter. I'm no longer an athlete. You kind of cross that line, and then it's really hard to kind of come back.
I left a lot of athleticism in 2011.
Anytime you probably got over maybe 220, I think, for that's me at least, was like, that's when athleticism and
power. I was 15 then, so.
Well, yeah. So it took me a long time to get there. But so I got into powerlifting after I was done playing baseball. I played Division I baseball in college and then played a little bit kind of semi-pro kind of knock around after that. Found myself...
like a semi-pro knock around. How does that compare on a Kenny Powers type of scale?
Well, it's actually pretty similar depending on where you're going to go. I was lucky because I was in upstate New York in Canada. And then when I moved out to California, oddly enough, where semi-pro ball is actually highly thought of and there's a lot of stuff to actually do, it's not a bunch of people showing up in different uniforms and just saying, oh, we're here to play baseball.
No one knows what team they're
exactly.
on.
Exactly. It makes it hard. But when I got out here, the team that I was recruited for and playing for, the league ended up folding. So I needed something to be competitive in. I'd always thought that it'd be cool to be strong. I was a baseball player, so we weren't allowed to lift.
Mm-hmm. All forearm curls.
It was
right.
Forearm curls and extensions and like the curly do things and like, for some reason, like calves. I have no idea why we did a lot of calf raises.
Well, calves, neck, and forearm are the most important body parts anyway.
That's true.
I used to coach high school football and would butt heads a lot with the baseball coach because we had athletes who were baseball and football.
Right.
And he's like, well, I don't want them to lift too much. And I was like, why do you think everyone in Major League Baseball takes steroids? Because being strong fucking helps.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you're also dealing with like 13, 14, and 15-year-old kids. You're like, look, these... He's 100 pounds. Yeah. He's 6 feet tall and he's 100 pounds.
I know he's going to get so jacked.
You don't want him to be muscle bound and really kind of screw up his delivery and sit back. Yeah. Sure, absolutely.
I get though why a guy like Roger Clemens had to take steroids because I've seen his training videos. when you're quarter squatting 135 on the Smith machine, steroids are pretty much the only way to get a training.
That's awesome.
Very, very true. But, so yeah, I wasn't allowed to lift, and you know, when I was in college, Paul Childress was my strength and conditioning coach.
Okay. So University of Buffalo,
Canisius College in Buffalo, yeah. So you know, he was lifting, and finally, kind of when I realized that I would like to kind of be strong, I went about it obviously in the wrong way, and read every muscle magazine that I could. And he eventually came and saved me, and kind of showed me a little bit of the path. And then when I moved out to California, I reached back out to him. And he put me in touch with someone up here in Northern California doing powerlifting gym here, and kind of started there and just worked my way through it. And
year was that? What year was it that you came out to California?
It's got to be close to 15 years ago at this point, so early 2000s or so, somewhere along there. I'm really bad with dates, but
yeah,
it's about 15 years ago, maybe a little bit more. That was the real early days of powerlifting. So I was lucky enough to have a really good kind of boss and job at the time, doing some training in San Francisco. And then the gym that I was at gave me a lot of freedom of like, go ahead, do whatever you want to. It wasn't a real strict have to do a program. So I got to play around and do a whole bunch of stuff and kind of learn on the fly, like what works, what doesn't for me, and then kind of apply it. But that's when there's a lot of, the interwebs were just growing and just happening to kind of come about. So there was a lot of cool stuff coming out, but it was a lot of just like bullshit. Do you remember that guy DB Hammer?
On
Elite Fitness.
I remember.
Like
that.
There was people in our gym trying to do like his stuff and like all the these secret German like strength programs and everything. So it was kind of cool because the internet was kind of coming about where you could you get in touch with and read a lot more Louis, Dave Tate, Jim Wendler, even a lot of Shaco stuff was out there with DeepSquatter.com. And all that stuff was coming about, but then you had all these just trolls just like putting out all their stuff, which was great because you could kind of see obviously who was joking around, who had a sense of humor, and then also who was gullible enough to try some secret, German throwing program.
Wasn't there a website around then? I remember that was like, you remember Kyle Gulledge? You guys remember Kyle Gulledge?
Yeah.
And there was like, maybe Dave was his brother's name.
Big deadlifters.
Yeah, huge. Yeah, he was pulled like 830 at 19 years old or something. But there was like a website. YouTube really didn't have anything.
Right.
It really wasn't even like, it might not even been out then.
Like training clips only, if anything.
If anything. And there was like some guy had hosted a website. I want to say it was like, it wasn't Iron Garm, but it was like
Iron Game.
Yeah. And it was like, all it was is just a bunch of links.
Yeah, it was just
videos that were uploaded. And there was like, I remember watching those videos and seeing like.
That was actually, I actually lifted with that guy. He's from Northern California.
Oh, yeah.
He's Hayward Blake IV. He was at IPF.
Sounds fancy.
He was the third.
Would I know him well if I didn't know the other three versions?
I don't know if you want to know any one of them. But he was a really strong kid, but I think that was his website.
Yeah.
And he had all that stuff up there. I haven't even thought about Hayward in a long, long time, but that's interesting. But yeah, that was his website.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So when you got into it, you were probably, 2003, it was probably like, relative to like where we are now, that
would have
been
looks
like
completely
all,
different.
I mean, yeah, I mean, how many women would even be in like the gym at that point in time?
I think we probably had like two in the gym and that a membership like, of about 40.
Totally
and like
barren.
at the meets, we didn't, I mean, we knew what raw lifting was.
Yeah.
But it wasn't an actual even category. Yeah. There was like single ply, double ply.
Right.
And that was it. So, you know, going to a meet, I don't remember seeing anyone until, I think the first person I saw do a full meet raw was Dustin Speed, probably maybe like close to 10 years ago or so. He was the first person I saw just go all, just all raw. And I think he had to lift in the single ply division, but he lifted raw. It was a different world back then. And I mean, meets were 20 to 30 people, probably no women, and they just took forever.
Yeah.
You know, just because of all the equipment and everything.
That's the same still.
So before we get too far into that part of things, that's the next thing we want to talk with Jesse about is, as he's been in powerlifting now for 15-ish years, seeing this sort of transition from equipped lifting to raw lifting, how that's affected him as a lifter, as a coach, and just how he sees culture change in the sport. So we're going to be back with Jesse Burdick on the Jug Life podcast.
Guys, your bathroom called? It's time to give it the cleaning it deserves. Get rid of all that junk that's lying around. Freshen it up with high-quality products from Dollar Shave Club. Members get everything they need for their morning routine delivered right to their door. Dollar Shave Club is more than just razors, and it's way better than going to the store and buying expensive razors. They have everything you need. Razors, shave butter, shampoo, body wash, toothpaste, everything you need to look, smell, and feel your best. Even though I have a beard, I can still use the high-quality razors from Dollar Shave Club, the Executive Razor, the best razor I've ever used to clean up my neck, clean up the cheeks, and their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter is fantastic. It goes on clear so you can see where you're shaving. And since Dollar Shave Club delivers everything to you, you don't have to set foot in a store, wandering the sales aisles, hunting for razors, shampoo, body wash, toothpaste, none of it. Clean up your bathroom and your morning routine. Join Dollar Shave Club today, and for just $5 with free shipping, you'll get the 6-blade Executive Razor Plus trial sizes of Shave Butter, Body Cleanser, and One Wipe Charlie's. Then keep the blades coming for a few bucks more a month. Get yours at dollarshaveclub.com/juglife. That's dollarshaveclub.com/juglife.
All right, we are back on the Jug Life podcast here at the Power Wad in Dublin, California, with Jesse Burdick. And you know, Jesse was just telling us about how he got into powerlifting back in 2003, training under Paul Childress, a pretty legendary equipped lifter. Now has been a part of the sport as an athlete, as a coach. I know elite total in 5 different weight classes.
Yep.
Right. So you've seen a lot of things as a lifter, and an undeniable transition in the sport from 2003 where. Yeah, the WPO and multiply was, you know, you were saying it was either single ply or multiply.
Yeah.
Raw lifting was not a thing to now, you know, maybe you go to these meets and could find one equipped lifter.
Right.
If that.
Yeah, even, yep.
So how was the transition for you competing equipped to now competing raw?
So the transition for me was pretty much an easy one where no one was competing in double ply anymore. You know, I think I did my last equipped meet was one of the backyard meets of the century or whatever they were called with Mark up in Sacramento. And there was nobody else there. And, you know, so
you won.
I think I did, yes. But that's besides the point. But, you know, the whole point of all this was I needed something to compete in. I didn't want, you know, I had no interest in being a bodybuilder and getting on stage and doing all that stuff. You know, I wanted to compete against other people where it couldn't be just a completely individualized sport. So I figured, like, well, if everybody else is going raw, then I might as well, I kind of have to go raw too.
Yeah.
So that was kind of how I just transitioned into it. It was just like, there's nobody else here doing this stuff anymore. And at that time, I had left the gym that I started with, so it was pretty much just me and a bunch of raw lifters and a bunch of new raw lifters. Mm-hmm. So no one knew how to help me put a suit on, a shirt on, and you know, I'm squatting 900 pounds, benching over 6. I have no spotter, I have nobody to hand off to me. So it's kind of one of those things where it was, you know, a necessity that it was time to kind of move on to something else, but also because there's just no competition anymore as far as just actual people being there. And there wasn't a lot of people to lift with, which is, you know, part of the powerlifting that I did enjoy a lot of is having kind of a team with you. But it's a necessity, especially when you're in equipment. So that was kind of the transition for me. And you're absolutely right, man. It is, it's so different. Thinking back to the first meets, to like APF seniors and everything, to, you know, the big meets that we have now, it is completely the opposite. You know, maybe you would have one person raw back then, and now I think I've run, for the past 2 years, I think I've run about 6 or 7 meets, and I can count on one hand the people that were equipped.
Yeah, and I think it's not just a, you know, really not just a shift in the way that people are competing, but it's like the style and the culture of everything.
Yeah.
So last week on the Beers with Chad episode, I did a Mount Rushmore powerlifting. I identified these different eras and talked about multiply powerlifting era, a late 90s to 2010-ish, and then the modern era, raw lifting from 2010 to now. And Chuck Vogelpohl was my choice for the multiply era.
Great choice.
And I think he embodied so much of what was powerlifting culture then.
Yes, 100%.
Just being like so incredibly hardcore. And the perfect, you know, the picture I chose to use my extensive Photoshop skills to put him on Mount Rushmore, you know, he had the flame beanie on.
Yes,
and
fire beanies.
Chuck Vogelpohl, you know, bleeding out of his nose with a flame beanie on is multiply powerlifting.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
100% right.
That's it.
And I
mean,
you know, that, I know that photo well, and that's when he his strap broke, so we had to put electrical tape on his strap to even kind of keep everything together. He came out and pulled that last deadlift, I think, to beat Kenny Patterson and somebody else to kind of win that year's WPO. But yeah, that's a you. I don't know if you could have hit the nail for, you know, further and perfectly harder on the head than that. That's 100% multiply powerlifting. Yeah.
What do you think something from that era and that culture that powerlifting today and today's powerlifting culture would be well served to learn from?
I think the intensity and kind of the focus on a lot more of a team, I think, was certainly there. And again, kind of had to be in a, you know, multiply, just to get in the suit, get in the shirt. And then there are just people who are wizards in equipment, opposed to people who were not. So you'd find those people, you'd seek those people out so they could help you figure out how to adjust your shirt, how to put whatever on, you know, differently, or how to kind of approach a lift, or even, you know, how to adjust your equipment in order to make it there. So I think there was an attention to detail and intensity, because when you're lifting something, you know, when you put a suit on and you're lifting something that's going to be close to 50 to 70% over what you can do raw, you kind of got to turn things up a little bit. You know, it's no longer a like, hey, I'm going to do, you know, a set of 5 here at 75%. That's cool. But I mean, now that you're doing, you know, but if you can lift 500 and you got 800 pounds on the bar, you got to really kind of turn things up. So the intensity level of all the training sessions when you're equipped and going heavy for like an actual competition lift were, you know, completely insane. And it was a lot of fun. It was very, very cool. And I think there's a lot of intensity to lifting now, but I don't know whether it's the, you know, the lack of a team or the lack of the amount of people there, but the difference is, to me, you know, someone who has felt kind of both, is definitely palatably different than from when it was kind of in the hardcore multiply day, as opposed to kind of the raw days, where, you know, I think while, you know, in both instances, if you're going for a max effort attempt, you're like, hey man, I could end up in the hospital after this. I think with the multiply stuff, you're like, I may never wake back up if it rolls off my back, or if it rolls up, or I don't get the spot that I need. You know, now it's, you know, 900 to 1200 pounds, you know, on the squat, opposed to maybe, you know, a 600 to an 800 pound squat. You know, the spotters are going to be able to handle the lighter weight a little bit better. So I think there's an intensity factor that's maybe not as prevalent, but I mean, it's still there. But I think the teamwork thing is, or just the kind of sense of a team, sense of a community, is a little bit lost.
Do you think that the like the sort of legend of Chuck Vogelpohl kind of came about because, I mean, obviously for who he is, but like he was inaccessible. Like I remember reading about him and being like, this guy is like, you know, this guy's amazing. And same with like weightlifting. You read about people you've never met.
Right.
And then now as the community has kind of gotten smaller because there's more Instagram and everybody is like, you know, you might know the top lifters or have communication with them.
Yeah.
So like their reputation and legendary status is a little bit less, you
for
know,
sure.
amazing. And so like, yeah, it's kind of funny to me. Like you, like Vogelpohl was like, even to this day, you're kind of like, I've never really like seen anything on him. Like there's a training article here or there. And you're like, this guy's like this fucking insane monster guy
yeah.
that you're like, okay, like you watch the video of him pulling, you know, 800 or whatever. And it's like, it kind of gets you inspired really, really like a lot more for your training sessions. Whereas now it's like, it's a more accessible. Everything's more kind of readily available. So people maybe don't have that sense of like,
I think
you know,
like the mysticism.
Yeah. Right?
Like if all you had seen was a black and white still photo. I mean, you still knew that there were flames on the beanie.
Right.
Yeah. You know, right. Black and white still photo in Powerlifting USA with a meat write-up.
Yeah,
and I think that those were written in a way to
a little embellish,
try to
include
sort everybody
yeah,
and embellish
yeah.
where you could.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And a sense of you know epic
yeah.
Viking type of warfare to it. But now you could see, I mean, shit, you probably see 80% of people's training
right.
leading up to
right,
a big
right.
U.S. Open or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, It was almost kind of extra cool because you had no idea what he was actually doing.
Yeah.
Well, and then Louis would, you know, never tell you what he was actually doing because Chuck didn't lift with him at that time. So he had no idea what he was actually
right.
doing.
Right.
So it was one of those things, all you would hear is stories and then, you know, kind of the stories and, you know, then you'd kind of see some of the videos and those are kind of just small snapshots of, you know, kind of the culture of, you know, what was kind of going on there at Westside with Chuck and everything. But, yeah, I would agree. It's, you know, while him pulling 800 and, you know, doing all this stuff was insane, there's probably like 20 other people doing the same thing, but we didn't know about them. It was just that Louis had a little bit, he had the name out there. He was kind of he was the one that was kind of pushed forward the
right,
most.
Right.
Where if we open your phone, you probably scroll through and probably see like 16 people who just deadlifted 800 pounds last week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now I think it's like, oh, which is hilarious. You know, to me, it's like, oh, just, man, everybody's deadlifting 800 pounds.
Another 800 deadlift, right?
It's almost gotten to the point where it's just like, there's the one guy who can do it like a Chuck. And now it's just like, oh, someone pulled 800, lives at 165, you know, and just kind of spin through. So
what do you think was like the big turning point for, obviously people just transitioned to Raw and stuff, but like, I mean, he had the Mount Rushmore with Dan on there, like that transition from like Chuck Multiply to like, what was the first time you saw Raw lifting as like, holy shit, like there's, you know, Raw lifting is this thing that's much bigger or, you know, was there like a moment where you, you know, saw like a Raw lifter or a particular guy or a certain meet where like now it's like, shit, this is like real?
You know, looking back on it, I think there was a couple of things that kind of happened. And, you know, when it first started, it was, you know, get fucking huge. It's all about leverages. It doesn't matter what you look like or your muscle mass or anything. Just put a suit on, put a tighter suit on. So it kind of went from that. And then you saw people kind of drift into like, then you saw Chuck, who was like 220 and shredded. And he was lifting with the big guys. And then Big Iron happened, where they had all these, you know, smaller lifters. And they're hitting numbers that were competing with the big guys. Then I mean, they're putting up numbers that were just not seen by anyone under 242, and they're hanging with everybody. And they looked good, and they're, you know, they just looked
right.
shredded. They looked like they lifted. So there was that, and then it started to drift even more. You know, with the you know, with the Lillibridges kind of coming out, and then with kind of Dan Green. Dan Green was the first Raw lifter where I kind of, and it was up at Sacramento, where I kind of looked at him and was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
It's like, what just happened? You know, and it's, I think Dan has a reckless way about the way he kind of lifts, but I mean, it's just, he's just completely committed.
Like when he does the first rep and you're like, wow, that was really
And then he
hard.
Does four more. Yeah. You're like,
holy shit.
And you're like, he's been to the gym here and I remember he's like, oh, I'm just like worked up to 700. It's like, oh, we'll see what I can get. Okay. And just grinds one out and shaking the whole time.
Yeah.
And he's like, three more. I'm like, oh my God. Like, oh no. It was just me spotting him. I was like, oh God. But he was the first one that kind of kind of turned it on to where I was like, oh, wow, this is something really different. And then Milan was kind of coming along at the same time, putting up numbers. But it was, again, that was kind of a cool part, too, because no one knew who he was. And they're like, is he Raw? Is he not Raw?
Yeah.
But he's kind of in a suit sometimes, but he's not. But he still squats over nine.
Because he'd have the Super Cup of Titans and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there was right around that time when, you know, that was with Andre and who was the other Russian who he'd always finish second, or who would always finish second to him, or Yarmbosh.
Believ.
Yeah, Andre Believ. Those guys who were kind of going back and forth between, you know, both Yarmbosh, Milan, Believ. You know, that was when it was just like, oh, wow, there's people who are stronger Raw than they are in gear. And that's when I think the wall just kind of came down, where, you know, when Milan squatted 900, you know, Raw for the first time, or whenever kind of that happened. And I mean, you were along the lines, kind of in the drive, probably the only American, I think.
Me and Robert Wilkerson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh,
only American squatted 900 back in 2011.
Right, and I mean, that's where.
That's back when 900 was a big deal. back when 900 was a big deal.
You couldn't find that on Instagram at the time.
No, you couldn't. And was that when you, did you do that the first time with that stupid mustache that you had?
Well, I don't know if it was stupid, but that meet, I did 865 at that meet. That was my second meet. And then a SPF Power Station Pro-Am Greater Cincinnati Convention Center.
Sunday.
You need more of an echo when you're doing this, but you gotta.
Yes. I'm surprised that powerlifting has never been like attached to like Monster Jam or something.
The monster,
like the
truck,
big truck thing.
That'd be great.
Like, have a powerlifting meet in the center on like the tabletop jump, and when some guy pulls the final deadlift, like the Gravedigger drives and flies over the top.
Well, they say the WPO is coming back this year, and it very well may be there.
Okay, so we're gonna see that soon.
Yeah,
haven't they been saying that for the past couple of years?
Hell yeah. You know.
Hopefully it'll come. Maybe it'll happen.
So outside of just the culture, though. But the lifting itself, what was the biggest challenge coming from equipment into Raw lifting? Maybe some adjustments you've made for your own training for people you coach?
It's the intensity versus volume, where, you know, in equipment, your volume was very low, only because you could only do, you couldn't do reps in equipment very well.
And some of that's just that the weight you would do the reps with aren't going to put you through the right places.
The right range of motion, and it's not going to be kind of the same kind of competition lift that you would want to do. So there was the escalating weight, you just couldn't handle much more after the kind of main session. So I would say, you know, with the intensity being super high with the multiply lifting, the volume was very, very low. And then when you take the equipment off, and you can't do that, you know, you go like bar, plate, done. Like, that's not work. That's no work. Mm-hmm. So we had to find, you know, for me as a lifter and a coach, it was more about finding a way to force people to, you know, force feed volume to people in ways that are, whether they knew it or not, was gonna, you know, positively affect, you know, muscle mass, also strength, and kind of go from there. So that was the biggest thing for me. And also, I think the recovery aspect of things was so different in equipment, you know, central nervous system wise, you're just so wiped out. And it's, again, because of the intensity and everything. Yeah. Where, you know, not only is the recovery different with being Raw, but your frequency can be much higher as well. So you're able to, you know, turn your two or three sessions in equipment into six sessions over a week and get so much more out of it and be able to recover much, you know, much faster and more efficiently from it as well. So, you know, it was... You know, the people who did go from equipment to Raw with me, you know, we kind of had to really figure a lot of that out as we kind of go. Because, you know, we would know, like, you know, we would bench, you know, at that time, I think my bench was like 400, you know. I'm going to just work up to, you know, plate, quarter plate, and then I'm done for the day. It's like, that's not a workout. That's not anything.
Well, I think probably when Max started powerlifting, because you were sort of the one to introduce Max to powerlifting in a lot of ways, right?
Yep.
That you were much earlier in that transition time. And though Max's upper body would tell you otherwise, maybe you guys weren't doing enough volume here.
Well, yeah. at least they're not making fun of my shoes.
That's true. That's one step ahead of it. But yeah, it was a learning process. And I mean, I do remember, you know, way back in the day, kind of comparing kind of a Louis Westside you know, template to kind of what Shaco is doing. And, you know, Shaco is using a lot of Raw lifting and dealt primarily with single ply. So when I started to look at that and kind of compare the two, you know, I kept kind of the same conjugate system because just the schedule, you know, I'd been doing it forever and it made sense in my head. But taking a lot of stuff where he did and some of the, like, you know, not a small of, but just what they were doing overseas, anyone who was doing a lot of single ply stuff,
yeah,
we were able to take a lot of that and kind of add that in to things. And I think that helped me kind of start to mold what it, you know, kind of what we're doing today.
That's too, with the single ply lifting, why a guy like Milanichev and why there's so much more carryover between those Checo equipped programs versus, I think, the more strict West Side type of stuff. If you look at a IPF single ply lifter do a squat and you look at a raw lifter do a squat,
it's almost the same.
They look really very similar. Much the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
And where if you look at Chuck Vogelpohl do a squat and 99.9% of raw lifters squat, they have nothing, nothing to do with each other.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's where you're absolutely right. That's what kind of where the carryover kind of came from. And, you know, a lot more concentration on, you know, having that, you know, the first two movements just be very dedicated to the big three lifts, opposed to really kind of blurring some of the lines with, you know, board press, shirt, throw bands and chains and whatever else you kind of want to throw on there. It becomes a whole different thing. So, you know, kind of taking a lot of the bands and chains off the bar and, you know, trying to perfect technique, raw technique, which is different than, you know, like you said, just different than equip technique, double ply equip technique.
Have you found that the kind of scope of exercise selection is just narrowed a lot?
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And I mean, it's obviously there's going to be, you know, testing periods and we're still, you know, trying to figure out what's going to work best. But, you know, we would always, as equipped lifters, I don't know if I for 5 years ever squatted except at a meet without bands on the bar. And now I don't think we just don't put bands on the bar for the squat. You know, we'll keep them on there for the deadlift because I think that, you know, forces people not to coast at the top and actually kind of push their hips through and utilize more chains on the bench than bands. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly changed the, you know, what we're doing and how we're doing it. You know, no longer are we doing, just because also shirts are gone. So, I mean, we're not doing much of that, but you know, it starts to narrow down the things and you find the things that work the best for you and you just repeat them every once in a while. You change some things here and there, but you know, overall it's really kind of cut down on a lot because
is there stuff from multiply lifting that was like a really multiply kind of thing that you still kind of use, even if it's maybe not the thing that you think is like the best, but you just really enjoyed it or think it was a really productive thing?
I'm still a fan of box squatting. And I still think, you know, for me personally, you know, I knew if my box squat was, while I was in equipment, I knew if my box squat was good, my sumo deadlift would be good.
Right.
So I didn't have to put much on like training my sumo deadlift a lot.
You put like
826, yeah. And so I never pulled over 700 pounds, I think was the most I pulled. Yeah. In the gym, sumo, and then I'd be able to go to a meet and pull over 800. So it worked for me, and I still think like utilizing the box squat is a way to kind of trick people into, you know, using a little bit more hips if they're not sumo pullers or anything along those lines. But there's so many people who want to just pull sumo all the time and think that that's going to be the best way to do it and try and pull heavy, and then they get themselves beat up. So I think kind of having that there and mixing that in has positively helped people a lot in that aspect of things. But I mean, out past that and maybe like a board press for the bench, you know, there's not a, it's actually interesting. I think kind of the raw lifters actually added more deadlift variation to my program than the conjugate system ever did before that.
You don't do deadlifts and
right, you don't ever do that. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, you know, kind of the block pulls and, you know, more concentration on, you know, deficit stuff. You know, that was never there. We never did any of that stuff, you know, multiply. Well, and again, it's just completely different sports. Yeah. So you try and do a deficit in a suit, it's just not gonna, you're not gonna get down there to get the bar. Yeah. So I mean, it actually, you know, kind of switching over to raw added more exercise selection to deadlift, but it certainly shrank everything up. But yeah, I would say box squats and, you know, some board press. But I mean, you know, the board press is just kind of to kind of nail that lockout, and it's selective.
You know
what I mean? For people who are having a problem kind of locking that out, trying to just overload that point is something that, you know, a board can successfully do. Yeah. But past those two, Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we just don't use anymore.
Yeah.
And I, you know, unless someone's going to come in and want to put a shirt on or, you know, get in a suit, I've probably forgot about most of it.
What do you think is the most variables you ever used in one exercise?
Like, there was a time at the old gym that I lifted in up here, Diablo Barbell, where we would do the safety bar box squat equipped with bands and escalating chains. So you would do a set, add a chain, do a set, add a chain. I think they called it the Grazzletron. I don't know how it got to that name. I don't know. Disclaimer here, I don't suggest that, you guys doing
that's
this.
That's why you really needed a team for to do
absolutely.
That kind of training.
Absolutely.
Well, I would have just given up halfway through the setup.
Absolutely. Well, you're so right, dude. Yeah. You're so right. And I see a lot of people who, you know, still want to try and put some of these things together. Yeah. I'm like, I just don't even know if I have the patience to put a suit on,
right.
B, trying to set all this shit up.
Only one variable, I think, is if people do, they can change their stance, that's fine. They can change the bar with the regular stance, that's fine. Once you get to two variables, maybe. Once there's three different things going on, then all hell is broken
loose. That's just something that you're doing by yourself, let alone trying to put stuff on and set stuff up. I guess it would be a suit, box, safety bar, bands, and then you would be able to add chains. So like five, then you could add, you know, keep adding more chains.
Yeah.
I think, I used to screw around with, because I was trying to come up with a way to do band releasers. So
I believe Max has told me about this.
Yeah, that was, he almost died. It was amazing. So we would set up stuff like that and try and screw around with some stuff. But past that, you know, I don't know if there, maybe a shirt, board, bands and chains.
I like when the bands go from the top and the chains go from the bottom.
That's so right. It's somehow it cancels each other out and makes you stronger.
That's muscle confusion.
Or, like chains with the slingshot kind of thing. I was like, aren't these doing
that? That actually is really good. I'll argue for that one. Okay. That one is good, but the reverse, but I have seen people do reverse band board press with chains in a shirt. I have never done it, but I've seen it.
There's one inch of range of motion there.
That's
super hard. It's easy off the chest, impossible at the top, but right in the middle.
It really gets the good work in, which is what you need.
I've seen bands on occasion, too, be going not up and down, but forwards and backwards.
Yeah. I think that's odd. We can differentiate it, you know, kind of between main lifts and, you know, accessory lifts. That'd be an accessory lift just to try and force people to use their lats on their deadlifts. But on the one that you're probably talking about is, you know, safety bar and has it in front.
Yeah.
You know, after a while, you know, if you're a businessman and this is what you do, you also got to start to factor in, like, if I fuck this person up, like, this is not good for business.
Yeah.
So if I have a safety bar that's up here and then bands that's pulling them this way, and I'm going to ask them to try and do something athletic, the chances are, the chances are someone's going to get hurt, or, you know, it's just someone's going to be like, that just doesn't look quite safe. They start to escalate, and that's where the difference is.
Tough to explain to a judge.
Like putting a band around your neck so that when you get to the bottom, you start to pass out.
It's really called
the David Carradine.
Carradine method. All right. Well, we're going to take another quick break, and we're going to be back to talk to Jesse about some ways maybe we could make powerlifting more popular, more competitive, and run bigger, better meets. All right, so we're back on the Jug Life with Jesse Burdick. And Jesse, you know, besides being a lifter, a gym owner and coach, also runs some really big meets. Reebok Record Breakers, March Madness, big meets up here in Northern California, prize money, all that good stuff. And I've talked about this before on other podcasts and other episodes, you know, some ideas to make powerlifting kind of more interesting to fans, maybe, you know, get it on TV, as we were just griping about how there's cornhole competitions on TV, but powerlifting and weightlifting still can't make it on there. So You know, what are things that you see as a meet director, ways that powerlifting can be better presented to the audience and maybe, you know, made more professional and more appealing?
So when I started doing the meets, my whole intention was to just make the lifter experience a lot better, because there wasn't a lot of meets going on here. And if they were, they were taking 13 hours, and you know, you're deadlifting at 10:30 at night, and you've been there since 10 o'clock. So I wanted to concentrate on making the lifter experience better, mostly because of my athletes just didn't have anywhere to go. And then, you know, I would always think about, you know, my parents. I'm sure your parents the same thing. And you just talked about, you know, going to, you know, a track meet and your sunburnt, and, you know, just destroyed for 10 hours. And you know, just thinking about going and being a fan, you know, I love going to powerlifting meets, but they're exhausting. You know, yeah, they're going to be, you know, all day long. And, you know, if you're there for one person, they're going to be on the platform right. for almost 2 minutes. You know, at best, they're going to be there for 2 minutes. So I thought about just like, okay, well, how can we keep that, you know, keep the fan, you know, fans interested, you know, mom and dad, keep people coming, because they're going to come and support whoever is going to be there. But let's make it a little bit more interesting for them. So, you know, I kind of thought, picked up the stuff from Jim McD about kind of the live feed, trying to make that better, trying to add commentary to it. At the meet themselves, not charging anyone to come to the meet to kind of get in here. I think that's one of the most criminal things that I see, is people charging to support your kid for, you know, a minute and a half or whatever it is. So dropping that, trying to get more people in here, trying to have vendors here and almost turn it into a mild spectacle of some sort, if you will. You know, so they can kind of go and shop. We usually have food trucks, and you can kind of get outside and move around and do some stuff to make it interesting when whoever you're there for isn't lifting, which is most of the time.
Yeah.
So I started doing that, and then, you know, I was just like, you know what, I really want to do something, because I loved the WPO days. I thought they did great. You know, I still remember, you know, I was there when Goggin squatted 11. I was there, you know, the infamous picture of Chuck. And those were the place was electric. It was just awesome. The energy was crazy.
And this, for the kids at home, the WPO, World Powerlifting Organization.
Yes.
It's kind of like a one-off, really big multiply meet at the Arnold. You know, probably flames shooting out of the stage.
Yep.
You know.
Ring, card girls walking around with the weight.
Was it televised at all?
No, it never got televised. The only powerlifting thing that ever really got televised was Hawaii Record Breakers and then the Mountaineer Cup.
Yeah.
So my goal wasn't, you know, to try and get this on, you know, on TV or anything, but, you know, just improve lifter experience first, then, you know, kind of the viewer experience second. and then, you know, trying to get better lifters here. And I was able to hook up with Reebok and kind of pitch the idea of, you know, incentivizing lifts. Basically saying like, hey, come here, break a world record, we'll give you $1,000. Because that's what Lou used to do back in the WPO days. He would give, you know, he would give people $1,000 if they broke an all-time world record. And I was able to find myself in a position to offer that. And that started bringing more and more people to the meets, and it kind of elevated kind of the status. And as that kind of happened, I was able to kind of fine tune some stuff, you know, get better audio video equipment for the live feed, you know, and try and, you know, get more vendors, you know, better food trucks, different food trucks here. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, just from a meet director standpoint, just doing that, you know, really kind of, I guess, put, you know, our meets on the map. And, you know, it's helped a lot. To kind of continue pushing it, you know, I think some of the biggest stuff is you got to focus on kind of the lifters themselves. You got to bring out some characters. And you got to have people, you know, the guy who everyone's going to love. You got to have the guy that everyone's going to hate. You know what I mean? You don't have to WWE it where, you know, you got these just huge clash. But there needs to be some sort of, you know, some characters and some sort of, you know, development so people can identify
some
with
story
the lifter,
line.
Some storyline for sure. So I think that would be great. And I think just to continually incentivize the, you know, people, whether it's at the meet or, you know, I think it would be great if we could get to a point where we could subsidize somebody for a year, where you're like, hey, come to the meet. If you win, we're going to give you $40,000 for the next year, something along those lines. I think not only would you get a lot more people here, but now you're gonna start to pull some people from some of the other sports who are like, well, shit, if I spend 3 months busting my ass and lifting for this meet, I have a really good chance of being able to just kind of cruise for the next year, or however they're gonna go ahead and think it. So I think something like that, continually putting up money, trying to develop characters, and just trying to, you know, even if it's just like having a dedicated YouTube channel to it or something, mm-hmm. and just having the meets visible is gonna, you know, increase, you know, awareness of who these lifters are, what they're doing. And then maybe, you know, you can think about like, okay, cool, we see, you know, like my lifter Kaler, right? You go see him deadlift an all-time world record, you know, and then you follow him around at home, you know, he's playing with his dog, he goes to the gym, yeah. like that whole stuff.
Get into that human interest stuff. Absolutely. Is a huge piece, I
yeah.
think.
I think
that's what people love at the Olympics.
Right.
They latch on to the fucking curling. Yeah.
Story.
Curling won the gold medal in the Winter Olympics this year. No one gives a shit about curling.
You're going to get so much backlash for that.
Did you know that there's like 900,000 yeah. people who do curling in Canada?
There's
or
curling. So I looked this up. There is curling in Oakland. There's a curling deal, and one of the lifters at our gym works at the ice rink and said he can get us in.
Well,
apparently it takes forever. It's like you do 10 throws 8 times. It takes like hours to do. It's exhausting. Yeah.
You could get really drunk during that time. but it's like, you know, no one gives a shit about the sport of curling itself. But everyone was getting behind this team, you know, because they knew that the guys were like regular guys. They're like working at Ace Hardware, you know, and curling to try and, you know, support their Olympic dream and getting to know people beyond the sport, whatever it is. I think it is a huge piece of the attraction. So you've been able to work with Reebok in supporting the meet. I know you've also, you know, also had lots of interactions with Rogue and stuff like that. Do you think that powerlifting could be made into a viable enough thing where one of those where bigger sponsors are willing to come on board and give some real support to it?
No. very unfortunately, you know, but very honestly, no, I don't. I think that, again, it was because there's so much infighting in powerlifting mm-hmm. where if, you know, if Rogue was to go ahead and get me, you, and 6 other people, you know, from around the world to talk about powerlifting, we're all going to have really clashing opinions. We're all going to, you know, I hate this person or I hate that person or this federation, that federation. There's too much, it's just spread apart too much. And there's no one organization.
So power lifters are the problem, not powerlifting.
the sport itself is great. I don't even know if it's the lifters. I think it's a lot of the people who are, you know, sometimes putting on the meets, starting these organizations. And look, I'm not, you know, knocking anyone for trying to make a living or anything along those lines. But you know what? You know, I make no money off the meets that I run. I literally make zero. And it's for the lifters, and you know, it certainly helps me, you know, visibility-wise, you know, just here and globally. But you know, it's not a money maker. So if people are going into it trying to make money, I think it kind of really spoils things a little bit, because if people were able to kind of just really get behind a couple of people who are, you know, the leaders in what's going on, that would be great. But we have people, you know, I can't tell you the backlash that I've had when I put up money for all-time world records. Like, well, why not the Masters? Why not this? Why not only Raw? Fuck you. I'm like, guys, Jesus Christ, no one's put up $20,000 for a powerlifting meet ever.
Yeah.
Ever. That's when I started. But I get so much backlash for it. It's like, shouldn't we be happy that, like, someone is going to walk away with, like, maybe someone's going to walk away with a couple thousand bucks? Like, why can't we be pumped about that? And It's I don't know if it's the culture or what it is, who it is, you know, but I mean, there's just this aspect of like, you know, it just seems like there's so many powerlifting trolls more than any other sport out there where, you know, it's very, very hard to take a step forward because you get a backlash from every direction possible. And it's hard to want to take a step forward knowing that you're just going to get a bunch of shit thrown at you.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, It's unfortunate, but I think it's going to be very hard. I think, you know, we're seeing more and more individuals start to be able to shine and start to kind of get picked up by some of those companies, and they're going to be supported because they're consistent, you know, good lifters. You know, they have, you know, a good story to them. You know, they look pretty good. That's going to be, you know, those are the people who are going to succeed. But as a sport overall, I think it's going to be, you know, it's going to take something drastic or really, really interesting or a new way to kind of make things go, and a lot of support from everybody in powerlifting to make it happen.
Largely, I agree with you that it would be very difficult to unify all of these, not necessarily opposing, but individual groups in it.
Yeah.
It would really take like one you know, Saudi prince.
Right. Right.
Fucking loves
totally.
Powerlifting.
Totally.
And it's just like.
Buys it all.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, U.S. Open? That's cute prize money. And then
right.
I'll just put up $1 million.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's $1 million because that shot out of the ground in my backyard this morning.
Absolutely.
And I love, like, that DBX Fitness Championship, that CrossFit competition.
Oh,
that's more
there.
Money than the CrossFit Games.
Yep.
How much is it?
They're getting like $25,000 per event.
Yeah.
Plus, they were flying people to Dubai and putting them up for like 2 weeks.
And they were getting
appearance
fees too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the overall the winner was, I think, $250,000. But if they won all the events plus the overall, they would have won like $500,000.
Right.
It was
hilarious.
Yeah, pretty crazy. We covered a lot of good stuff. Max, any other?
No, that's good. I think we summed it up that powerlifters are non-athlete trolls.
Did we really do that? That's pretty much the podcast.
Damn it.
I was trying to make it better.
We polished the turd. All the powerlifting. No.
It's about as good as you can.
Jesse, where can they follow you, learn more about you?
Powerwad.com, Jesse Burdick on all social media outlets.
You can find me, Max_8 on Instagram or on Facebook. You can email me, max@jtsstrength.com.
And if you like the podcast, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us something funny or nice. Maybe I'll read it on the air, but I didn't pick one out to read today, so maybe I won't read one today. But when I do remember, that person could win something.
There you go.
We always appreciate that, and it helps more people find the Jug Life. If you're interested in coaching for powerlifting, weightlifting, strongman, power building, and super total, visit juggernautcoaching.com. Subscribe to our YouTube. 3 videos a week, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, brought to you by the world's strongest videographer, Shorty Sedang. And upcoming events, I don't know when this episode's going to come out, so I don't want to say I'm going to be wrong. So that's it. You can find The Jug Life on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. I'm Chad Wesley Smith, @ChadWesleySmith, and @JuggernautTraining on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your newsfeed all day. This was another episode of The Jug Life Podcast. Thanks for watching and or listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, man.